I'm going to begin with some music on the piano of Poulenc. Francis Poulenc was one of the great French composers of this century. As I mentioned the other night about Poulenc, he was a wonderfully witty and delightful man. He wanted people, when they played his music, to use lots of pedal. And he always said that if people are playing his music, and if they weren't sure how much pedal to use, then the best thing was to put it down on the first note and leave it down. You know, he would rather have it that way than too dry. He said it's like people who cook and don't put enough butter in. Poulenc was also a marvelous pianist himself. Composed a great deal of music, not only for piano, but for voice, for chorus, and was a great contributor to music of France. I'm going to play three little pieces of Poulenc. The first one is called Hymn, that's as in H-Y-M-N, a kind of grand piece with a kind of middle section that moves a little quicker, and it uses one little effect. One of the things that the piano has that people don't know what to do with very much is that middle pedal down there. It was mostly, people usually just forget about it. They know that the one on the right is the damper pedal and that when you push it down, you will get all the tones to keep ringing. And that when you push the one on the left down, every tone has three wires. And what it does is shift the hammers over so that it's only playing one wire per note. So it makes it a softer pedal. But the one in the middle, a sostenuto pedal, is basically used when you want to have one tone or one chord and it wants to keep reverberating while other things are going on. The most famous example, the program hasn't started yet, the most famous example is Rachmaninoff's Prelude in C-sharp minor, where that C-sharp wanted to be ringing like this. Anyway, at the end of this first movement, right in the middle, there's a big chord, and all of a sudden, the middle pedal comes into play to hold a big C major chord, which keeps ringing through all kinds of other stuff. The second piece is very quiet. It's called Pastoral, a kind of a wispy little one. And then I'm going to repeat the Toccata, which I played the other night, which is a sort of let it all hang out, wild finale to this suite of three pieces of Poulenc. Thank you. I'll cease there. Now the next piece, which I will play on the harpsichord, is one of the first examples of program music, in which the composer actually had a text to go along with the music. This was written in 1700. It was written by Johann Kuhnau. Kuhnau was the predecessor at the St. Thomas Church in Leipzig to Bach. There's no way in which he was as good as Bach. We don't have to worry about that. But he was an interesting soul, and Kuhnau was also a man who is credited with inventing the sonata. The sonata was a kind of musical form, and it is a very free kind of form. And he is most well known because he wrote a set of biblical sonatas, stories from the Bible that were to be given some kind of musical idea on the harpsichord. Now, for those of you that haven't had much time spent with a harpsichord, the difference between the piano and the harpsichord, the piano is, of course, the later instrument. In the earlier days, what you had with the harpsichord and these instruments was an instrument in which you have a single string for each note, and inside there is a little pick, what they call a plectra, that when you push down the note, it picks at that string, and that's what makes the sound. So you get this. Eventually, people began to find that that wasn't really enough sound for what they were looking for, and there's no way to make it louder in these pre-microphone days. And so, therefore, they had to go to something that would give more sound, and then they went from this kind of picked sound to a hammered on the wire sound. And the early ones were called piano fortes because they could play piano and forte. And we, over the years, just have gotten rid of that name and just call it the piano. And the difference is that, as I said, each of those has three strings. They're made of much heavier wire, and there is a hammer that strikes the string. So now we have this evening Johann Kuhnau's little tone poem sonata called The Fight Between David and Goliath. Now, I have to just say before I begin, this is not going to sound as if someone like Henry Mancini had done an arrangement. I mean, you have to remember, friends, we're talking 1700, and we're not talking quite, we're talking a little more primitive in our music, you know? But nonetheless, for folks in 1700, this was a big shock that you heard all of this stuff happening as program music. The portrait of the great Goliath drawn in the scriptures is a rather strange one. I'm reading from English rather than the original German. I didn't think you wanted that. It's very flowery, however, for here is depicted a freak of nature, a giant strong as a tree. Should one wish to determine his height, a measure of 6 cubits would scarcely suffice. The brass helmet he wears on his head contributes not a little to the appearance of his hugeness. The scaly coat of mail and cuisses, as they said, he wears around his legs, together with his most important shield, the one he carries, as well as the spear, the handle of which is like a weaver's beam and likewise heavily studded with iron, shows abundantly that he must be imbued with strength, and that all this load of hundredweights does not inconvenience him in the least. If one is already almost horror-struck at the mere description of this man, how terrified must the poor Israelites have been when they came face to face with the living original of their enemy. For there he stands before them as if he were trying to outshine the sun with his metallic armor, making an uncommon clatter with the metal discs that hang like scales one over the other, and snorting and roaring as if he wants to devour the Israelites all at once. His words sound in their ears like terrible thunder. He pours scorn on his enemies and their equipment, challenging them to send forth a champion from their camp. This fight is to show on which party's shoulders the yoke of servitude must weigh. Goliath can easily imagine that by these means the scepter over the Israelites will come into the hands of the Philistines. The terror of the Israelites at seeing Goliath. They sing a hymn to God. Behold the miracle. While courage sinks in all of Israel's heroes, while everyone, whenever the giant merely shows himself, takes to flight, and while the giant warrior continues to call out his habitual taunts against his enemies, David, a small, brave young shepherd lad, announces that he is willing to do battle with the Iron Eater. For this he is criticized as being presumptuous. Nevertheless, David does not let himself be deterred. He persists in his heroic resolution and goes to be heard by King Saul at his audience, telling him that he recently, with God's help, had fought with a bear and a lion who had stolen a sheep from him, that he had not only torn the prey out of the savage brute's mouths, but also killed them. Thus he hopes that he will succeed equally well in the fight with the Philistines' bear and lion. Hereupon he faces the mighty giant with a firm trust in the help of God, armed with a sling and a few carefully chosen stones. The Philistines presently think, now the great hero will blow away the tiny foe man like a grain of dust, or kill him like a fly, particularly since Goliath is getting very wrathful, fulminating against David with horrible curses to the effect that he considers him a dog coming to him not with arms worthy of a soldier, but with a shepherd's staff. But David is not dismayed. Instead, he calls upon his God and promises that the adversary would very soon fall to the ground without spear, sword, or shield, lose his head, and yield his body to the birds and wild beasts to feed on. He throws the stone. Goliath falls. And dies. the Philistines are put to flight. And the people of Israel rejoice. A concert of music is given to David in his honor, with the people from all of the Israelite towns coming in the various choirs with tabrets, violins, and other musical instruments, shouting, "Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s." Amen. Now that we may prepare ourselves for a moment of great theater, to put us in that mood, I'm going to play just a very quiet little piano piece, which comes from a group of wonderful pieces that were written by Edward MacDowell, who early in this century wrote a great deal of piano music and orchestral music. He's pretty much forgotten nowadays, which is too bad, but he left one wonderful legacy. If the music isn't known, the thing that he did leave was a wonderful place, a retreat center in New England, where composers and writers can go, but primarily composers, go for a month or 2 months, have a little cabin, go off and do their composing without being bothered by things like telephones and all of this, and it's called the MacDowell Colony. And Edward MacDowell did write a lot of wonderful music that ought to be heard more often, but I suppose if there's any piece of his that's well known, it's this little piece of his for piano called To a Wild Rose. I'm going to call on Carol Lutke to come here. As you know, last night she did the one-woman play, and I felt that it was important that we understand the historical significance of what we are about to view with Mr. Preeb, and therefore to help us understand and to appreciate this great moment. I'm going to call on Carol, please, to give us some background.
The theater is a place of human expression. It is a forum where humans enact their own experiences and mirror their actions, thus marrying a real and imaginary world. Many times, as in classical Greek theater, a character is presented as a symbol of man's frailty, as in the case of Oedipus Rex, where a great man falls from power and finally recognizes his own flawed self. But his self-awareness comes only at the expense of his kingdom, his lineage, and his family. The Greek audiences were extraordinary in size, and despite the numbers, sometimes up to 50,000, the theater goers who sat on a hillside watching an open stage became emotionally involved in the drama. Because of the play and performer, the audience felt pity, and as a result, knew themselves better when they left the amphitheater than when they arrived. A meaningful script for any performance is, of course, necessary for a powerful performance. And we can all recall such plays: Sophocles' Antigone, Shakespeare's Hamlet, King Lear, Ibsen's Hedda Gabler, George Bernard Shaw, St. Joan, Arthur Miller, Death of a Salesman. But a play is only a literary piece without the performer. The function of the actor or actress is to filter the words on the page to the theater goer. Literally, the actor must make a character come alive. He must transform words into human actions and thus create a meaningful experience. In scoring a role, an actor must first understand her character. A typical kind of preparation is extensive research and reading about the history and culture of the character. The actor must also apply his or her own emotional recall. In other words, apply similar experiences of his own or her own life to that of the character portrayed. Finally, that performer must forget and even submerge his own psyche and become that character. And to lose oneself and to become another is the mark of a gifted and talented artist. Movement and Richard Burton, Sarah Bernhardt, Ingrid Bergman, John Barrymore, and tonight Holden presents its own knockout performer.
For those of us who have seen this performance before, these words were touching. And therefore, it gives me great pleasure, if you will gaze toward the stage, to present Wesley Preeb in the immortal role of Florence Nightingale.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you first, before we start, that I was an actor once. I broke my arm and they put me in a cast. Knee slapper. Yeah. This story tonight is about Florence Nightingale and the dead dying soldier. Florence went to the Crimea, and it was a crime too, and she ministered to those poor, dead, dying, stinking soldiers.
I'll hold the mic.
Thank you. aching, dead, dying soldier. Tell me your name. Do you need a potty? Tell me your name that I may tell your mother. Dying, stinking soldier. Tell me your name that I may tell your mother. Soldier, why won't you tell me your name? Please tell me your name that I may tell your mother. Gee, my mother already knows my name.
For some of us who have seen the role develop over the years, from the 60s, I saw it first in 1964 and was touched by it then. And over the years, to see how it's been refined, I wanted you all to see it. I was very concerned about it. And Carol's words certainly just fit the mark. The program will conclude with some music of Henry Cowell. Henry Cowell was an American composer who did most of his work in the 20s and 30s, and his one big sensation was a great trip that he took in the 20s to Russia, performing as a piano soloist. Henry Cowell, I'll demonstrate from the piano. Henry Cowell said, he had certain problems about basic harmony. He said, if they say that two notes or three notes makes a chord, like these three notes, or these three notes, then why don't these three notes make a chord? Yeah. And as far as he was concerned, they did. And so he said, you know, any three, four, five notes together make chords. And so that if this is a chord, so is this. And so he had a broader picture of chord writing. Henry Cowell also felt that that one of the problems with pianists was that they were oftentimes exploring how to play at the keys, but they weren't exploring playing inside the piano, and felt that there was a lot more that could be done there. And so he wrote a whole series of pieces involving playing inside the piano, which actually was the pioneering effort that led to people like John Cage and a lot of others writing music of the same kind. It all went back to Henry Cowell, who was doing it in the 1920s. I'm sure many of you have done this, and this is one of those interesting experiences. And in fact, you kids, when you have a chance at home, you should try on a piano to sing into the piano. Because, and I'll tell you what you can do. How about one of you? Come on up here, would you? Okay? Now you can stand right over in here. Okay? Now, I can, if I don't put any of the pedals down, there is nothing free to resonate, to vibrate. As soon as I put that damper pedal down, it means that there is nothing damping the strings. And if you, I'll put this pedal down, if you would just sing one note, just short and loud, into the piano, it will sing it back to you, okay?
La.
You have to sing louder than that, okay? Because
La.
Wait, put the pedal down first. Come here we go. Sing right here, go.
La.
It's like that. And the higher, and you see I can do it. Bop. And it sings it back to me because it's a sympathetic vibration to what you're doing. You see? You can do that kind of thing. How about one of the other kids? Come on up here and try it. Sing it out. Come on. Sing it real loud.
Wah.
Oh, you sing much louder than that.
Wah.
Yeah. Did you hear it? It comes back to you. Now, thank you both. Okay, now let me show you what happens. So Henry Cowell said, there's a lot of experimenting I could do, knowing that there were vibrations that could be achieved. So one of the things he did is he wrote, and all of this is notated, and you're welcome to come up and look afterward, at the music. He wrote one piece called The Aeolian Harp. He wanted it to sound like one of those kind of native harps of long ago. And what he did is, the entire piece is to push down notes on the keyboard silently. Now, I have just pushed three notes down. When I strum across the strings, the damper, I'm not putting any pedal, so the dampers are next to all of the strings except the three that I've put down, right? So that when I go, there's only going to be three notes sounding. The three that are being pushed down. As soon as I release it, it's all gone. If I put the pedal down, it would just have, you know, everything going. So if you want to make a little piece, he wrote this little piece, and I'll just play part of it, called The Aeolian Harp. The only problem with that is that you must watch your
make sure you have calluses on your fingers. And also make sure that the piano is somewhat clean inside. Now the next piece is called the Banshee. And the Banshee, could one of you... And if you just keep it down the whole time, that'd be very nice, because I have to move over here. Okay. One of the things that he tried to create in all of these pieces was a lot of effects of sound and ideas. So, for instance, and some of them were very, 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 very quiet kinds of sounds. For instance, if you take and do this, pedal down, is it? Okay. If you take and do this, and just sort of strum along one string, a lot of the music was therefore just very, very ethereal. This piece starts like this. Tiger, and this explores the whole area of large tone clusters, because he said if you had a chord that was this big, or this big, just imagine how much more grand it became if you used your whole arm and achieved a larger sound. And all of this is notated very carefully here. What Henny Powell did is put the top note he wanted and the bottom note, and then puts a thick line between. And then if he wants it on the black keys, he just puts a sharp sign, you know. So it's all worked out very carefully. So that you know if you're going to play a melody like, if you were going to play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star on, you know, you could do it right there. And just know, you have to just make sure you angle exactly how far you want to go. So we will close the evening of whimsy with Tiger. And this uses also some of that harmonics where I'm going to be playing a chord like this, and then releasing it, except the middle pedal's holding it down while I go on to other things. And then also the effect, a wonderful effect you can get when you push down all the keys and then silently leave just a few held. You know, this kind of idea, for instance. All of that gets explored. All right. You can see why he was a big hit when he went to Russia. Yeah, Tchaikovsky hadn't written a lot of pieces like this. So.